This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Frances Dieder, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
You're more than welcome. It's lovely to meet you.
Frances, when we talk about the Black Nobility, what or who are we talking about?
Let's explain the name first of all. It's relatively modern. It's a modern nickname that they gave to themselves. They were the aristocracy who were living around Rome in the 19th century, and they were in support of a pope who had put himself into self-imposed imprisonment over political issues within the Vatican. So they all dressed in black and shut their front doors symbolically to say that they were not taking part in society until the Pope felt comfortable with the policies and the politics of the time. And that carried on right up until 1927, when the Vatican was established as an independent city, and the Black Nobility, who supported that pope, regained their position, their aristocratic position in Italy. So that's why they call themselves the Black Nobility. But the name has been sort of expanded to include just about any aristocratic or nobility family throughout Europe who are conspiring and always have been conspiring to reinvigorate the Roman Empire.
Are you suggesting that the Roman Empire didn't ever die?
No, of course it didn't. No. What the Roman Empire did was run away. As soon as it was attacked by the Germanic tribes who sacked it in 576, they simply ran away. And what they did was they ran to the marshes. They were in the north part of Italy, around Venice, as is now. At that time, there was no city there. It was just a huge marsh area of lagoons and islands. And so they ran off there, the Roman senators who had been driven out of Rome. They set up home in those marshlands because they were very difficult to get to and therefore could hide out. And it was horrible. Apparently it was a mosquito-infected horror of a place to live. But they set up home there in order to survive and continue with their globalist regime as they had planned it. It took a long time, and while they were there, they teamed up with pirates and the general seagoing community who were using those islands to hide treasure and whatnot. So they developed an agreement with who were the old Phoenicians, which is why Venice got called Venice, because Venetian and Phoenician are such similar words. We can assume that the two combined at that point. And their main trade was slaves, drugs, spices, and exotic fabrics from the East. So they were working from the East, bringing in as much as they could of wealth to Europe, but at the same time they were exporting Europeans as slaves. That's how they made their money and built Venice and all of the smaller towns around there.
Okay, why are we talking about the Black Nobility? Why do they matter?
Because they are the original families, senator families from the Roman Empire. Their modus operandi is to reinstate the Roman Empire, but they've done it by stealth. They matter because what they have done is they have established an empire of trade, not an empire of land and property like other empires have done in the past. Like the Roman Empire was land and property, which was difficult to defend. The Roman Empire had to spend a fortune on centurions and soldiers and roads and bridges. The Roman Empire had to spend such a lot of money in order to maintain its size. They realised once that Rome was sacked and they escaped, they realised that their empire didn't need to be a physical place. It could be a subject, and the subject was trade. So they made an empire that covered the whole world, and it's a trading empire. When that reached the point where it was completely dominating the Mediterranean, at that point, America was coming onto the scene, and I mean north and south, the whole continent of the Americas. And they realized that they needed to expand their empire to include that. So from Venice, tucked up at the north of Italy, that wasn't a convenient place for them to have as a base anymore. So they decided to move to Amsterdam. That move put them into close proximity with the aristocratic families Wettin and Welf, W-E-L-F. And those families wanted to take over the British Empire, or rather what was the British Empire at that time wasn't especially large. So William of Orange, who was a member of the Welf family, married into the British throne by marrying Queen Anne. And then on the back of his movement, the black nobility were able to take over the city of London, which they thought was a wonderful idea, because the city of London had been established originally by the Romans anyway. So they were considering, from their point of view, that they were simply retaking a piece of land that they had in the first place. Once they were into the city of London, they established it as an independent country, effectively, within. So it's like a 1 square mile of territory, symbolically walled all the way around, so that it isn't part of London, Greater London. It's a separate city. And because it's a separate city, it has an independent police force, an independent political system, independent laws. And everything that matters in the British economy is located there. It includes all our banks, our media, the big Fleet Street is famous for that, and that's in the City of London. Our biggest insurance companies are all located there. So nowadays, the way that they have power is still by trade. They consider banking is a trade. They consider insurance a trade. All of this empire is not based on actual land. It's based on making money. Now that they're in the City of London, they went on from there to establish Washington, D.C. as an independent city. So effectively, in 1929, once they had the Vatican as an independent city, London as an independent city, and Washington as an independent city, they had an empire which looked after spiritual values, financial values, and then military values in Washington. That was the empire consolidating itself without naming itself as an empire. It's very clever. It's hidden between three cities, all three of which are completely independent. And we've got the Vatican running the spiritual aspects, we've got London running finance, and we've got Washington, D.C. running the military. But it's one big empire, and it's an empire of trade rather than an empire of territory. It's revealing the most important aspect of this global octopus that we live in. Because let's face it, what we actually have is a global slave system that they operate. The main thing that people don't understand is that the Five Eyes, the five countries that are all English speaking, Great Britain, America, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, these are all the cannon fodder countries. These are the countries that have been populated by English speaking people. And literally, we are five slave colonies keeping this behemoth of an empire financed. And we are the suppliers of cannon fodder. Well, now, because of technological advances, particularly in the Department of Electromagnetic Radiation and similar technologies, they don't need so many soldiers and individuals to fight their wars. They've got tech to fight the wars. So the most important thing from their point of view, the Roman Empire Mark II, from their point of view, eugenics is the most important thing at the moment. So reducing the population of the planet is a really important aspect of their next stage, mainly because, like I said to you, trade is their empire. And trade requires commodities. And all these commodities in other people's countries are what they want. So if they depopulate a country, like they have done in Iraq and are working on in Yemen and in Syria, if they depopulate those countries, they then have the opportunity to lay their sticky mitts on any commodities that are under the ground, for instance, oil, gas, and metals. That's all it's about. We're just in the way. The humanity is in the way of them developing their empire to the point where they own everything. That's what they want.
You talk about how they have this immense control. And that's something that the Roman Empire itself wanted. So this is merely, as you say, an extension of that. And of course, with the use of technology, there isn't a real need to physically go into those countries anymore. You can do it subversively. Is that correct?
They've already done it. They're subversively in every single country on earth. The way that they've done it has been very clever. Got to grant them that. It's been very clever. They have the Jesuits, for example, under the guise of a holy order, are actually a military organization, and they set up schools and universities and colleges all over the world, and they have educated whole generations of people into the way that they want us to think. And it is now quite clear that they run this CIA, and the CIA is paid for by the American people, but doesn't actually work for American people at all. It works for the Vatican, and it works for the Roman Empire Mark II. And the object of the exercise is entirely to bring everyone into a situation where they live in a totalitarian state, and there is no escape. That's the objective. And then in the process of reducing the population as far as they possibly can, they will then do away with borders. There will be no more countries. It will be literally divided up into two areas, and those they refer to as the gap and the core. Now, the countries that are in the core at the moment are North America in general, most of Europe and Australia. But the countries that are in the gap are pretty much the middle section of the Earth, where we're talking about from South America across the Caribbean, right the way across Africa, India and China. So the whole band around the middle is called the gap. And what they seem to be doing, and it includes the Middle East, of course. So what they're actually doing is depopulating the gap forcing people to leave those areas for economic reasons, because their land has been bombed up with depleted uranium, because of wars, because of all the stress that they're putting onto people. They're forcing people to migrate from the gap into the core countries. Well, this is a double-edged sword, because in the process of migrating away from the stress, those people are putting pressure on the countries where they're going to. So they're arriving into the core countries and stressing the social security networks. And we all know how much illegal immigration is stressing all the countries in Europe, especially the UK and America. They're pouring across the borders in America. And we're all victims of this. The people who live in the core, we're victims of this supposed invasion of people from the gap. But the gap, people have nowhere else to run to, so it's not their fault either. They're just going to try to survive. So this chaos, this double-edged sword of chaos, they're victims from the gap, but we in the core countries, we're victims too, because we're being squashed up and our cultures are being mixed and mashed up so much so that it's causing tension and stress. And that's the objective. The objective is to make everything so chaotic that nobody can see the wood for the trees. They can't recognize that, no, it's not the Middle Eastern people being driven out and coming into our countries that are causing a problem. And it's not us being selfish that's causing a problem. It's the extremely wealthy. And I'm talking about people who are way above Bezos and Zuckerberg and so forth. We're not talking about billionaires here. We're talking about trillionaires, people who have multitude generations of wealth, and they are benefiting from all this chaos. That's why they're doing it. They're doing it so that they have the Roman Empire Mark II, where it's one organization. And it's a totalitarian organization. In other words, there is no alternative. They're not allowing another alternative. There is no communism and capitalism anymore. There's just totalitarianism. So you won't be able to vote because there's nothing to vote for. And there won't be very many people left anyway, the way they're going. They're making sure that we're heading into World War III so that we mutually annihilate, while they sit in their castles and super yachts and private islands with their feet up waiting for us to finish the job for them.
And those trillionaires are the black nobility.
Yes, that's part of it. The black nobility is a nickname that they gave themselves. In a way, it was almost the first colour revolution, because they chose to wear black in protest. It was just the first colour revolution. It was quite a clever idea, and it pressurised a lot of people. But when I use that term, I'm not just referring to those particular families who did that protest in Rome. I'm talking about all aristocratic families, all the nobility, monarchs, especially our own, the British monarchy, all of them are wealthy beyond imagination, and they do conspire and intermarry between each other to make sure that they keep their superiority and keep their money together within themselves. Now, this intermarrying business has caused them to have some problems with genetics. They tend to have died out, and they renamed themselves as well, so that the earliest names of the original Roman senators have obscured into the past, but now the new names that have taken over, but I can trace their origins right back to Rome, are the families such as the Saxe, Coburg and Gotha, the Orsini, the Farnese, the Medici, the Borgia, Aldobrandini. There are a lot of these families. And all of them, at some point or another, have had popes appointed from amongst their own family members. They keep these jobs for themselves. And when you listen to the way that they think, they actually think they're doing the right thing. They honestly do believe that what they are planning to do is for the best, because they sincerely believe that humanity is overrunning the planet and is destroying the planet. The royal family of Great Britain are famous for their green agenda. And it was King Charles, when he was still a prince, who introduced the Great Reset. And they're serious about this Great Reset. And what it amounts to is the introduction of totalitarianism. And when you read the Agenda 2030, which is being run through the United Nations, when you read that, you can understand quite clearly that this will be a system from which there will be no escape unless we disempower these people really soon, like now.
You were mentioning some family names, and two that always come up that you didn't mention are Rockefeller and Rothschild.
Yeah, well, that's because they're not old families at all. They are servants of the black nobility. Right back from when Rothschild was still in Frankfurt living in a Jewish ghetto, he was required to look after the money of some aristocracy who were running away, hiding from revolutionary activities around them. And what he did was invest that money, made quite a bit for himself, but got the original money back to the family where he got it from in the first place. And in that way, Rothschild built a reputation for financial acumen. He had five sons, and he taught those five sons his ways of operating, and then sent them out across Europe to five different locations and built an empire. One of those sons did very well and wound up being senior advisor to the Vatican for investments. Another one was in London, Nathan, and he almost bankrupted the British government at the time with his investments. So overall, the Rothschilds have been very important advisors and financial helpers to the black nobility. And the black nobility invest their money through the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and other people on a similar level. They like to employ the Jewish, they were called the Hofjuden, which Hof means high and Juden means Jews. So the highbrow Jews, the ones that were establishing themselves in the courts of the aristocracy of Europe, those ones were employed by all the aristocracy as financial advisors, and they still are right up until now. But this has worked against them a bit because people only see Jews at the top of the banking system and they presume that's where it ends, that's the ceiling. But it's not, because if you think about it, it's not the people running the banks that are in charge. It's the people whose money is in the bank that the bank is working for. And the people who've got their money in those banks, the big central banks, and BIS, the one in Switzerland.
Augustin Carstens.
These are the...
Talking about Augustin Carstens? He's the head of the BIS, if memory serves.
That's right, yeah. Big guy. Yeah. Rather large.
Yeah, he ate all the money.
Yeah. Well, he might. Yeah. Well, all those people are all working for the black nobility. And they are, well, you could pretty much say this is the staff. And they always employ Jews because they like to keep up a veneer. The black nobility like to keep up a veneer of Catholicism, of Christianity. They're Christians, but they're not Christians at all. But they like to keep that image going. And the only way that they can do that and run banking systems at the same time is to employ Jews who don't mind using usury. So they employ the Jews to run their banks and keep their hands clean. They're above it all. And the Jews run their banks for them and invest their money for them. And they sit with their feet up in, you know, Monaco, basically, or in Switzerland and doing nothing. They don't actually earn any money. They don't need to. The old money builds on itself constantly.
Is there a connection with the black nobility and I suppose the British Empire and the creation of Israel? Because we know Rothschild was connected to Balfour.
Oh, yes. Well, the black nobility, I mean, there's a lot of speculation about who is at the very top of the black nobility. I'm of the opinion that among the very top is our own royal family, the Windsors, because that's not their real name. Their real name is Saxe, Coburg and Gotha. That's their family name. And they are descended from the Guelph, and they are black nobility. Also, the reason I think they're at the top is because of the amount of property they possess worldwide. And it's prime property loaded with minerals and other extractable wealth. So I would say that the British royal family is at the top. In 1917, the Rothschilds Zionist Federation of Europe put pressure on the British government to guarantee them a homeland in Palestine. And they did it with a letter to Balfour. And Balfour was able to confirm that the British government would do that, which was a bit cheeky because they didn't possess Palestine as such. They were only a guardian of Palestine at that time. To a certain extent, I think the British government in 1917 was pressurized into agreeing to that idea by financial issues. Because at that time, between 1914 and 1918, we were in the First World War, and therefore finance was very tight. And I guess that because they needed extra finance and their financial advisors were the Rothschilds, they agreed to this idea of giving the Jews a homeland in Palestine was a good idea. That's what they thought was a fair exchange for the support they were getting from the Rothschild family. What they didn't realise was the middle paragraph of Balfour's letter stated that nothing should happen, nothing untoward should happen to the Arab residents of Palestine. Nothing should be done to displace them. Well, when in 1948 Israel was finally established via the UN, they conveniently forgot that paragraph and just started the Nakba and displaced the Palestinian people from their land and have been saying ever since that there weren't any people, any Palestinians. But I mean, I've heard many, many Israelis say it was an empty land to be taken over by a people with no land. And that's just not true, because there's plenty of evidence, photographic, films, coins, passports, all sorts of evidence that there was a thriving community of Arab people living in Palestine before the Israelis turned up. There's also the point that Israelis were, rather not Israelis, but Jewish people from Europe were being persecuted long before World War II. from the end of World War One, Jewish people were being put in pogroms, what they called pogroms, all over the place, and being driven out of Europe, being harassed and driven out of Europe, and were making their way to Israel because they knew about this agreement with the Zion, that the Zionists had made with the British government. And so they started to go there, and they took the population of Jews in Palestine from 3% up progressively until by 1948, they were more than half of the people in that country. So it was very slowly done over a period of time. And the Israeli government now neglects to mention about how that was achieved. What they did was they made life a misery for the Jews before World War II, before they even started what they called the Holocaust. Long before that, people were being driven out of Europe. I have a grandfather who was driven out of Czechoslovakia purely because he was Jewish. And that was, he arrived in London in 1920. So long before the Holocaust, people were being harassed and moved away. And so I know that from, you know, in my own family history, that was the truth. And a lot of Jews didn't want to go to the Levant. They didn't want to go to Palestine. They were European for generations upon generations. They had businesses, they had families, they had lives here. They didn't want to go and live in a sun-baked desert and start from scratch. But they were forced to, and so they did the best they could with it, and they have done very well because they had to. They had to survive. So I feel very sorry for those people that were driven into Israel by what happened in Europe, because now they're being manipulated by an extremist government. And I wouldn't even call them Zionists. I think they're worse than that. They are totalitarians, and they know what they're doing. They are persecuting their own people as much as they ever persecuted the Palestinians.
Horseshoeing back to the black nobility, you mentioned earlier that they are not Christians, but they like to maintain that facade. What is the relationship between the black nobility and the Catholic Church?
If you think of the black nobility as the original Roman senators, only descended. Now, let's go back to the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire established Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire. And it did that because, as I said to you before, maintaining this vast empire was expensive, and they couldn't afford all these soldiers and centurions and roads and bridges and buildings and God knows what. So they realized that the Christian religion, which was giving them grief all over the place because it was very popular, it was spreading by word of mouth, very popular. They thought, if we take this religion on, we can use it as a mind control mechanism, so we won't need soldiers because they'll all be scared of God. They won't be scared of soldiers with swords and battering rams, but they will be afraid of God because we'll teach them to be afraid of God. So they've got to keep these laws, which will be our laws, and they've got to live in a certain way so as to earn their place in heaven and not upset God. It was very, very clever. So what they've done is actually support all three Abrahamic religions. That's the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims, because all of those are working as mind control operations, keeping everybody behaving themselves. Meanwhile, the senators and their descendants, the black nobility, the aristocratic families of Europe, they're not Christians or Jews or Muslims. They're atheists and nihilists. And you might remember from Albert Pike's doctrine, he talked about three world wars. And when he was talking about the Third World War in his letter to Manzini, when he was talking about the Third World War, he said, "We will unleash the atheists and the nihilists." And that phrase stuck in my mind. For a long time, I was like, who on earth are they? Who are these people that are going to be unleashed on the world? And that's when I realised, well, it was not immediate. It took me a long time to put it together. But I realised in the end that atheists are people who do not believe in God. And nihilists are a stage further than that. They not only don't believe in God, but they don't believe in any form of afterlife. They believe that you get this one life and that's it. No more. That's it. They have no spiritual value or belief beyond that. And that's what they're doing. That's what they are. The black nobility and all the aristocrats and all these people that are descended from, and there are a lot of them. I'm not saying this is a small group of people because it isn't. It's a large group of people. And they have influenced a lot of other people too. But they are nihilists. They don't believe there's a future for your spirit once you're dead. And that's why they have ploughed so much of their resources into finding out how to become immortal, and why people like Ray Kurzweil has been set up with his own goddamn university to find out how to create a one consciousness. And I find that absolutely hilarious and so limited intellectually. How on earth can they be possibly setting up a one consciousness when we've already got that? That shows you the level of ignorance of the nihilists. They believe that when they get to the end of this life, that's it, there's no more. Well, that's where they go wrong. That's their mistake. That's what makes them so evil.
Where do the Jesuits fit in?
Oh, they're lovely, they are. We get them coming along from Loyola. He was a soldier. He was from a Basque, but he was from a Basque nobility family. And he went off to become a soldier, fought in wars, got himself really badly injured in one leg and wasn't able to go back out to fight any more wars. And that was really disappointing for him because that was all he lived for. It was his thing. So then he spent a lot of time in isolation by himself and he developed a form of spiritual awareness that made him realise that you could mind control very easily just about anybody if you beat the resistance and the independent thought out of them. And he did that progressively until he created a small group. I think there were only about 600 of them when he presented his idea to the black nobility family Farnese. And the Farnese thought, well, yeah, this is a really good idea that this guy's got. And they sent him off on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And when he came back from the Holy Land, they got him an introduction to the Pope of the time. And then they were able to persuade the Pope of the time to recruit this man, Loyola, and his friends as a kind of military monkhood. A group of people who were neither military nor monks, but somewhere in between. And their modus operandi was to teach and to set up schools and universities and to infiltrate governments and other aristocratic areas in order to get them all to implement this totalitarian way of thinking. And every one of them takes an oath whereby they are obedient to the Pope. Now, up until Pope Francis, we never have had a Jesuit Pope. This is the first Jesuit Pope. And the changes that have gone on since this Pope has been in have been quite shocking. You can see that the Jesuits have been expanding at a terrific rate. And what they do is they have what they call the vanguard, which means they've taught a whole generation or several generations of people to think in the way that they want them to think. And those people, as the vanguard, act on a voluntary basis as spies in the community, pointing out anyone who is not a Christian, who is dissident or in disagreement with the edicts of the time, anyone who is difficult or argumentative. And these Jesuit-trained vanguard keep notes on people. I've actually met people that do this. They keep diaries and newspaper cuttings and notes on people's lives. And they submit this information up the chain, just like the Nazis. They did the same thing. They did exactly the same thing. In fact, Hitler did frequently say that he admired the Jesuits. At the same time, some Jesuits were in South America, particularly Paraguay and Uruguay, and what they were doing was setting up communism. They set up communism by preventing the Indian tribes from having their own independence and from turning them into communist communes. And they practiced for 150 years before they then passed this new idea, this communism think, onto the likes of Marx and Lenin. And then, of course, the Jesuit missionaries also went into China and they taught communism in China. So they converted, they practiced on South American Indians and then converted Russia and China to communism based on what they had learned in the reducciones. That's what they're called in Paraguay. The word in English is reductions. And you can find all this online. It's, you know, it's not as if any of this is secret. It's just not all together in one place. So it can be, it has taken me 10 years to ferret all this information out and put it all together.
And the Jesuits have also been kicked out of a lot of countries as a result.
Yeah, that's another thing that gets forgotten. They were even dismantled completely by one pope and then reinstated. But they were responsible for the French Revolution, the American Revolution. They instigate revolutions in order to destabilize countries. That's one of the things that they've done, but they don't own up to these things, obviously.
Didn't a couple of the early US presidents, as well as Napoleon, speak against the Jesuits?
Yeah. But look what they did to Napoleon for having the nerve to do that. They stuck him on an island by himself in the hope that he'd go crazy. Yeah, they're vicious people. They believe, and they do sincerely believe, that they are God's representatives on earth. And that if you do not believe in God in exactly the same way that they do, then you should die and God will deal with you. And they think that they are doing the right thing. They have the most distorted morality you could possibly imagine. And they do it with a smile on their face because they actually do think that they are doing God's work. I don't think that that is any kind of relationship to Jesus Christ, the man. You know, they use his name, Jesuits, suggests that they are the followers of Jesus, but they don't behave like Jesus. Not at all. When did they ever heal anybody?
Francis, would you mind giving me a summary?
As I've said, we are in the Roman Empire Mark II, and we don't have a lot of choice. I think truly the most urgent task of this generation is to definitively liquidate the manipulative horror that is the black nobility of Venice and Rome and London, Washington and the Vatican, and dispense with that oligarchical hierarchy once and for all. I don't think we have any choice.
How do we do that?
by spreading the information out as to every single person. It is heartbreakingly difficult to do that because they have control over all forms of media. And when I first started to do this, to talk about this and to put all these tenets together into an understanding that we're still in the Roman Empire and we are all slaves, when I first worked that out, I was immediately thrown off of Facebook, Twitter, Discord, Zoom, Skype. I am so shut down to prevent my understanding from even being heard, let alone thought about and considered and researched. You can research everything I've said and find it, even on Wikipedia. It's there. I didn't make any of this up. This is what I've read in books and online. Now, admittedly, a lot of the sources that I have had over the last 10 years have vanished from the internet. You know, as fast as I can find them, they'll take them down. Any information about me has been taken off of the internet. All my interviews, photographs, events I've attended, stuff that I've done, all of that has all been wiped off of Google. It's gone. You can find access to my Substack account now, and that's all, which is ridiculous because I've only had a Substack account for the last 3 years. Before that, you know, I'm 72 years old. You can imagine I'd done a great deal before the last 3 years. All of that's missing. Everything has been wiped off. And that's what they do. They wipe you off. They disempower you. They discredit you. And if that doesn't work, they'll kill you.
You mentioned the British family, the royal family earlier, and I wanted to ask you a question and I forgot. What do you make of Diana? Do you think she was awake?
Oh, yeah. I think she was. I don't think she was to begin with, otherwise she wouldn't have married him. But I think she came to realise what was really going on and it thoroughly sickened her. You can tell that by the causes that she championed, like the landmines cause. She knew what was being done. She knew. And that's probably why she was murdered. Because there's no doubt she was murdered. Anyone that does find out and does work out what's going on, like JFK, for instance, they get wiped out, dispensed with. So I realise that what I'm doing is a very risky business to, in my own name, come out and say what I've found out instead of using a fake name and trying to pretend to be someone I'm not. I'd rather just come out and say, look, I'm Frances Leader. I'm a woman from London who worked in the City of London and found out at a very early age what's really going on. And then over the years, and that's a lot of years, I've pieced it all together. And I feel like I'm a grandma for the world. You know, I'm 72 years old now. Everyone's younger than me. Well, most people are younger than me. And I feel really sorry for them because they're not being told what is really going on and therefore they can't put anything right. And everyone wants to put things right. No one wants to do evil. And a lot of people are going to, when they hear what I have to say and realise that they're a slave, they're going to be thinking, oh, my God, I've spent my whole life supporting these trillionaires. I've spent my whole life working in their system for them without knowing it. Now, that really hits hard when you think about it. And so I have a great deal of sympathy for everybody hearing what I've got to say because I know that it's going to hit them hard and that they don't want to be in a totalitarian system where there's no opportunity to have an independent thought in your head. Nobody wants that. But that's what's being forced upon us.
I just want to clarify something. You were talking about the British Empire earlier. Would you say the British Empire and by extension the American Empire are offshoots of the Roman Empire?
They were the Roman Empire. It was just called the British Empire, but it was never British. It didn't belong to the British people. And the American Empire doesn't belong to the American people. we're conned into believing Britain had an empire. Oh, wow. No, we didn't. They had an empire. We were just getting it for them. We were working our backsides off. Our people were dying to get that empire for them because it was never British.
Frances, you mentioned your Substack. How can I find it?
Well, you just look up Frances Leader and you'll find me on Substack.
And your work is phenomenal. It is very extensive.
Thank you. I love doing it. I don't like knowing something that other people don't know. I mean, if I thought you wanted to know how to crochet, Joan, I'd tell you. I don't like the fact that there are secrets. Mm. There's no need for that. Let's get rid of the secrets and then we can all deal fairly with each other. And we will stop victimising other victims because we're all victims of this system. And I would like to see that before I die.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.